Now invite Brother John Mulholland forward to deliver his class, the first part in a series on Abraham and Sarah. Brother John.
Good evening, everyone. Abraham and Sarah, part one, walking the journey of faith together. We continually hear of Abraham and the promises, but there is more to Abraham than the promises. Genesis chapters 2 through 25 is as much a story of a husband and wife, their marital problems, their family life together, as it is a story of God's promises. The Bible reveals God being active in people's lives. It is not a textbook. Rather, it is more a diary of God's activities in people's lives. Therefore, we want to see Abraham and Sarah as real people we can empathize with, a husband and wife walking the journey of faith together. And it is quite a journey, taking about 100 years of walking some 2,500 kilometers from Ur of the Chaldeans to Bethel in the land of Canaan, another 600 kilometers into Egypt before returning to Bethel, and then walking throughout Canaan many times until they are both laid to rest in the cave of Machpelah. When they actually left Ur of the Chaldeans is a point of conjecture. Some use the difference in the 400 years mentioned in Genesis 15, verse 13, when Abraham was about 85 years old, and the corresponding reference of 430 years of Israel's total sojourning mentioned in Exodus 12, verse 40, to mean Abraham was about 55 years old when first called by God in Ur of the Chaldeans, for that is where he received this calling, according to Stephen, in Acts chapter 7 and verse 1. So we ask, is 20 years a reasonable time to wait in Mesopotamia? We know God doesn't work overnight developing faith in any individual. Rather, he does it over a lifetime, progressing step by step. The first step being the establishing of trust that God is the only living God to be worshipped. Promises are never a first step, for they are only meaningful when you trust someone to perform them. So God did something first to cause Abraham to trust him and leave idolatry. Perhaps it was a sign. We know Gideon required a sign, fleece to be wet and the ground dry one night, and the reverse the next. We know Hezekiah required a sign, the sun going back 10 degrees. What happened between God and Abraham is not revealed, but something did happen, causing Abraham to trust God. And not only Abraham, but his family as well. For Genesis 11 and 31 tells us, Terah took Abraham his son, and Lot the son of Haran his son's son, and Sarah his daughter-in-law, his son Abraham's wife. And they went forth from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. God is telling us Terah took them, not Abraham. So Terah also trusted God, having left idolatry. What we have is a family being called by God to come out of idolatry, out of whom one man and his wife are called to leave and go into a land God would show them. Terah took all the family, not just Abraham, Sarah, and Lot. For Genesis 22 and 20 tells us, it was told Abraham, Milcah has also borne children unto thy brother Nahor, who we find living in Haran. Genesis 24, verse 4 tells us Abraham instructed his servant, you shall go into my country, to my kindred, and take a wife unto my son Isaac. Abraham's country wasn't any longer Ur of the Chaldeans, the land of his nativity, the land of his idolatry, but instead it was Haran in Padan Aram in northern Mesopotamia, where his kindred, the rest of Terah's family, resided. Terah took them all out of Ur of the Chaldeans. But Genesis 11 and 31 refers only to Lot, Abraham, and Sarah, because they alone were the ones that actually went into Canaan. Genesis 11 and 27 introduces Abraham and Sarah in these words. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begat Lot, and Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abraham and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abraham's wife was Sarah, the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran. Genesis 11 and 29 also tells us that it was in Ur of the Chaldeans that Abraham married his half-sister Sarah, and his brother Nahor married his niece, Milcah, which raises the question, why would they marry their nearest blood relative? Terah's two wives, his oldest son Haran's wife, or wives, are not mentioned, implying they married daughters of another family, or families. So why the emphasis on internal family marriages? Why did Abraham insist upon Isaac marrying his nearest blood relative, his cousin Rebekah? Why was Jacob sent to his nearest blood relative, his uncle Laban, thus marrying his nearest blood relatives, his two cousins, Leah and Rachel? Such marriages were not uncommon then and are still practiced today. But our interest isn't about marriage customs, but about the biblical emphasis regarding these marriages. We know the law of Moses forbade marriage outside Judaism. And we know Paul emphasized, be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. So perhaps, as Abraham and Nahor sought wives amenable to their newfound belief, they found themselves restricted to a half-sister and a niece within their own family as their only choice of wives in an otherwise totally pagan community. Though we cannot be sure this is the case, there is reason to justify such a conclusion. We must not forget that God would first have broken their bond to idolatry, to trust in him instead, before giving Abraham the first promises. So there would be a time period of the family developing a trust in God before the promises were given, a time wherein possibly Abraham and Nahor were not yet married, but they were a lone family in a land full of idolatry. So 20 years is a reasonable time period for their being in Mesopotamia after receiving the first promise. Allowing time for God to establish a family base, not in Ur of the Chaldeans, but in Haran, that would provide the source of suitable godly inclined future wives for Isaac and Jacob, as God established the promises in Abraham's and Sarah's progeny in Canaan. So we see the promises being revealed in the story of a husband and wife, apparently taken out of a believing family, who God then, over their lifetime, brings them to a perfection of their faith. The promises are not all for Abraham alone, for both are intimately involved. Both eventually have their names changed. Both together are acclaimed by God to be the father of many nations and the mother of nations. Both together are to protect faith such that their bodies are made fruitful again, that together they might conceive the son of promise in perfect faith. That is the way the story is told. For in Genesis, they are continually referred to as husband and wife, some 27 references in total. It is a story of a marriage with all its ups and downs, a story revealing the throes of marriage, incident by incident, as much as it reveals the promises. We can see the Bible is God's diary of his involvement in people's lives, revealing him as a living God, personally active in our daily lives. That is the important lesson we want to take heart from this story of the marriage of this man, Abraham, and this woman, Sarah, his wife, walking the journey of faith together. The story of Abraham and Sarah is essentially a series of short stories about them when Abraham was 75, 85, 99, and 145 years of age. Chapter 11 covers the period of 55 to 75 years of age, telling us God called them as a husband and wife. Chapter 12 covers a period of about 1 year, Abraham, 75, 76 years old, when they first entered Canaan and subsequently walked through going down into Egypt. Chapter 13 is probably only a few months later, being the aftermath of the trek into Egypt, returning with so much wealth they have to split up, Lot going down to Sodom, leaving Abraham and Sarah alone in Canaan. Chapter 14 follows on, perhaps months or perhaps a few years later, we do not know, introducing Melchizedek and Jerusalem, which are essential to God's purpose. Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, and the place where God's name will be forever. Chapter 15 seems to follow shortly after the events of chapter 14, describing the first covenant given Abraham. Up to this point, God gave him promises, but now, having accounted righteousness for belief, God gives him a covenant. Chapter 16 is when Abraham is 85 and 86 years old. A story of enduring the distress of Sarah's barrenness and their personal solution to fulfill the promise, with its resulting troubles affecting their marriage. Chapter 17 is when Abraham is 99 years old, when God gave them a second covenant to be a father and mother of nations, and changing their names to Abraham and Sarah. Chapter 18 is a very short time after, entertaining three angelic visitors, receiving the promise of their son to be born in exactly 1 year's time. chapter 19 starts at the end of the same day, Sodom and Gomorrah being the catalyst, forcing Abraham and Sarah into a final trial of their faith, a three-month period when their faith is made perfect, that the Son of Promise may be conceived in perfect faith. It is also the story of Lot's unhappy life in Sodom and his salvation from destruction because he was a righteous man, vexed by the wickedness of Sodom, as Peter informs us in his second epistle. Chapter 20 is the latter part of those 3 months, where again they are separated, with Sarah now being in Abimelech's house, the aftermath of which is their perfected faith. Chapter 21 is 9 months later, when Isaac is born, and then includes about a period 3 years later or so, when Ishmael and Hagar are put out of the household. Chapter 22 is probably when Abraham is 135, for God compares the sacrifice of Isaac to the sacrifice of Jesus, who was about that age when he was crucified, and which compares then to Abraham dying 40 years later, as did Israel after Christ's crucifixion, when Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. Chapter 23 is when Abraham is about 137, the story of Sarah's death and Abraham's preparation for them to await together the resurrection in the cave of Machpelah. Chapter 24 begins about 2 years or so later, Abraham obtaining a wife for Isaac from his kinfolk, whom God had established for this purpose in Haran. And chapter 25 is 35 years later, when Abraham is buried with his wife Sarah in the cave of Machpelah, there to await together the resurrection. So we have a record of their married life in a series of events, most of which occur in just 25 years, when Abraham was 75 to 100 years old. And it's described in four incidences which Abraham and Sarah share together as husband and wife. Three others where Abraham alone is mentioned, but obviously she, as his wife, is intimately aware of what trespasses. It is a time of two covenants, one to Abraham when he was 85, and one to them together when Abraham was 99. Then, very fittingly, their life together ends on the oath of the covenant given at the sacrifice of Isaac, where the record of Sarah's death immediately follows. That is a timeline summary God has chosen to reveal of Abraham and Sarah, his wife, walking the journey of faith together. Genesis 11 and 30 very specifically tells us Sarah was barren, she had no child. A phrase setting the stage for all that follows in their life. The promises, the covenants, everything is built upon that one statement. God did not choose Abraham, but chose Abraham and Sarah, his wife, because she was to be barren. She was to have no child out of their marriage, but to have a child out of perfected faith in what God promised them. An interesting thing about that phrase is the Hebrew word translated child, a word which occurs only here, is derived from a root referring to a male child when used in the singular and children when used in the plural. It is because she was barren, hence no children, but more so because she was barren, having no male child. The promises, the covenants, are meaningless without that one fact. That is how great an importance this phrase conveys. Everything that follows is built upon that one fact, culminating in a male child out of perfect faith. Regardless what sign God showed them to trust his word, the driving force moving Abraham and Sarah, his wife, to leave Ur of the Chaldees to go down to Canaan was a promise they would have a male child. We see the reality of that in Genesis 15, verses 2 and 3. Abraham's answer to God, "What will you give me, seeing I go childless? You have given me no seed." And Sarah's offer to Abraham in Genesis 16, verses 1 and 2. "The Lord has restrained me from bearing. Go in unto my maid that I may obtain children." Actually, it says, "that I may build." That is, Sarah is saying that I may build a house for Abraham. What a cost for Sarah to say that. In the privacy of her own tent, no doubt in tears and anguish of sorrow, in desperation, she gives her husband another woman so she may claim that woman's children as her own. We look upon the promises as the rich heritage foundation of faith. But to Abraham and Sarah, his wife, the promises were a great mountainous burden, so great that Sarah came to view them as applying only to Abraham. And he, no doubt, came to feel the same. Out of this despair, Abraham had a son, Ishmael. And for 13 years, they were father and son. All the while, Sarah was play-acting as his mother. Ishmael's real love was to his father Abraham and to his mother Hagar, not Sarah. Sarah was simply the reason for his fortuitous circumstances he enjoyed. So we can understand Sarah's decision to substitute Hagar into the promises, because the wording of the promises of the years never identified who would be the woman that bore the child. Genesis 12 and 4, "In you," spoken to Abraham. Genesis 12 and 7, 13, 15, and 15 and 5, "to your seed," spoken to Abraham. Genesis 17, 7 and 8, "to you and your seed," again spoken to Abraham. No mention of the woman. Each promise was spoken to Abraham. So Sarah, remaining barren, came to the conclusion she would not bear the child. So herself is not directly a part of the promises. Even the promise in Genesis 17, 7 and 8, even with her name changed, even being told she would be the mother of nations, there is some 50 years of despair of having not conceived. 50 years to believe only Abraham would have the child promised. And 13 years seeing Ishmael as that son of promise. It is very difficult for us to wrap our minds around the impact of God's promises upon a barren marriage. Going through our reproductive years, then into old age, when we are no longer capable, and then hearing the promise being made again. 50 years of conditioning is not easily overcome. The promises were Abraham, in name, being spoken to him. But in reality, they were to Abraham and Sarah, his wife, to a marriage just as when God brought Eve to Adam to fill the earth with their progeny. The promises were about the purpose from the beginning, to fill the earth with a godly family. And that required both husband and wife to develop absolute trust in what God said, the very opposite of the marriage of Adam and Eve. The commandment was spoken to Adam, but Eve shared being Adam's wife. In the beginning in Eden, it was the wife who lost her trust in God. And when we read Genesis 21 and 1, it is Sarah whose trust was the critical element. The Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bare Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. In the end, it is all about Sarah, not Abraham. Sarah is visited. It is done unto Sarah. Sarah conceives. Sarah bears a son. That is God's emphasis, as God tells us the story of the promises in Abraham and Sarah, his wife. Let us backtrack a moment. For the promises made to Abraham in Mesopotamia were all about him, not her. The emphasis was upon Abraham. You, your. The promises begin with an emphasis upon Abraham and end with the emphasis upon Sarah. If the initial emphasis is upon Abraham, we might ask, was it given before or after their marriage? Which is a good question, but unanswerable, for we are simply not told. But the way the promises are worded, they could be given either before or after their marriage. But they definitely could not be fulfilled without a marriage. The promises could be viewed as a reason for their being married. Yet the promises may also be viewed as better spoken to a man who is married with a wife that is barren with no child. We might also ask, what did Abraham and Sarah understand of those initial promises? For a start, it was on the strength of those promises. As a married couple, they left Haran for Canaan. And based on those promises, they would go into Canaan, looking forward to having a child or children in that new land. No doubt all the time they spent in Haran was time spent in anticipation of the day they would go into the land, expecting Sarah's barrenness to become fruitfulness when they arrived there. The premise of the promises is going into a new land to receive their fulfillment. So when they entered Canaan, and the Lord gives them another promise, in Genesis 12 and 7, to your seed will I give this land, their expectation would be buoyed up. Not only buoyed up, but they would note there is a complete shift of emphasis from Abraham to his seed, which Paul reminds us in Galatians 3 and 16, the Hebrew refers to a single seed, to Christ. If the Hebrew phrase is singular, Abraham and Sarah would recognize it to be singular, that the land would be given to one seed only, not the nation mentioned in the first promises. We should not doubt that they were in some way taught of God of those things recorded in Genesis chapters 1 through chapter 11. And therefore they would recognize this particular seed mentioned in this new promise would correspond to the seed promised in Eden to destroy sin. That would give them an assurance Nothing would happen to them in this life to prevent their having children. We must not think Abraham and Sarah did not know the Genesis record of creation, nor must we think they would not recognize the seed promised them was the seed mentioned in Eden. So with that added dimension to their understanding of the promises, they begin their walk south, walking down through the land. And suddenly, they realize the land is devastated by famine. God has added a wonderful promise, and immediately a new buoyed up trust is put to the test. Interestingly, the record is silent about any prayer being made to God as to what they should do. The way the story unfolds, it becomes obvious Abraham made his own decision to go down to Egypt. And again, at Egypt's border, Abraham makes his own decision, fearing he might be killed, revealing how weak his faith was in those early years. He didn't equate his seed requiring he had to stay alive. There was no threat to his life because he had to live to have children, as promised. He felt fear. And rather than pray to God, he prejudged the Egyptian's response to Sarah being his wife. So looking at Sarah, he feared they would kill him for her beauty and instructs Sarah to say she is his sister, not his wife. That day, Abraham solved the problem. But to say she is his sister placed Sarah in great danger, for she was then eligible to be taken as a wife. And that is exactly what happened. Abraham hadn't thought it through. He only took into account his own perceived predicament, neglecting to take into account that decision made Sarah eligible for marriage. What Abraham did was to create a deliberate lie. Doesn't matter if she was his half-sister, for half-truths are used to deceive by withholding the other half of the truth. In this instance, the half held back was that she was his wife. Once on that slippery path, the charade must be kept up. And Pharaoh, in innocency, sent for Sarah to be his wife. We know from the book of Esther that kings often held a woman for a preparation time period before actually taking her to wife. So we have Sarah obeying her husband, learning to be another man's wife. And all the while, her husband is being made rich through the bride price Pharaoh paid for her. And of course, Abraham was now in an unfixable fix. He couldn't reveal the charade, and a far worse fear overcame him. He has defrauded Pharaoh. No doubt, there was now much prayer to God, being forced by the outworkings of his decisions to turn to God. And God did act, not for Abraham, but for Sarah he acted. Genesis 12 and 17. The Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. It is not because Abraham was in danger for his life. He wasn't, but because Sarah was endangered being in another man's house, that God plagued Pharaoh. Not just one little plague, but many plagues, described as great plagues, concerning which we are given no information. But for sure, Pharaoh took quick notice, and he quickly figured out why. Abraham's faith was like Peter's when he saw Jesus walking on the water and asked to come to Jesus. Peter walked on the water, that is, until he looked around him and saw what was happening. Then his faith failed and he began to sink. Just as Abraham's faith failed as he looked around him and made those two fateful decisions. And the result, Abraham was drowning. And God put out his hand to help Sarah, and that rescued Abraham. Just as Jesus put out his hand and brought Peter safely back into the boat. When Pharaoh released Sarah to Abraham, he sent them away, back to where they came from, back to the safety of the boat they were to stay in, the land of Canaan. On that trek back, I think we can all envision Abraham not wanting to look Sarah in the eye over what he had done. That trek back into Canaan afforded them both time to reflect upon the lessons taught them. That God is active in our lives. It is necessary to trust him. It is necessary to pray to him for guidance. And it is necessary to heed the answer God provides. That they learned the lesson is evident in the promise God next gives them when they have returned to where they had first built an altar to the Lord. They are back at the beginning, the very same place where God had promised Abraham his seed would inherit the land. In effect, they are starting over, entering the land again, as though they had just entered the land months earlier. But God has seen a difference in them and gives them more promises. This time it is you and your seed together who will have the land. And your seed will be innumerable. And because you and your seed inherit the land together, you are now to walk the land that is to be yours. The you of the first promises is now married to the your seed of the second promise. Their faith had progressed and now they shared in the promise of the seed. And never again do Abraham and Sarah, his wife, ever leave the land. So we see in this incident the action described in Hebrews 11 and 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that God is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. We should not think Abraham and Sarah were poor, ordinary folk. We have no idea of their circumstances in Ur of the Chaldees. But in Haran, they had gathered substance and had gotten many people, either as employed servants or bond servants. They were a fairly large household that went down into Canaan and then down into Egypt. How great, we do not know. But Job, described as the greatest man in the East, had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household to manage all that. That describes Abraham, where Genesis 14, verse 14, says he had 318 servants born in his house who were trained for warfare. And they would be in addition to those he would have left behind to care for all his substance. Pharaoh gave a good bride price for Sarah because she was from a wealthy household. Had she been a poor man's daughter or sister, the bride price would have been in proportion. Very little, if anything. Pharaoh gave Abraham sheep, oxen, asses, cattle, men servants, maid servants for Sarah. A vast sum for her, not just for her beauty, but as recompense worthy of her family, her status in life as a sister of a great man. Afterwards, when leaving Egypt, it is said Abraham was very rich in cattle, silver, and gold, meaning he received a tremendous sum for Sarah that simply made him unbelievably wealthy. When we realize that, we can readily understand Abraham's reluctance to fess up to his deceitful claim, "She is my sister." He had handsomely defrauded Pharaoh. It was seen publicly throughout all Egypt. He not only defrauded Pharaoh, he shamed Pharaoh before all Egypt. Yet Pharaoh refused to take anything back. No doubt the plagues had made him realize the God of Abraham and Sarah was not to be trifled with in any way, shape, or form. Then there is Lot, who, being with Abraham, would have benefited from what had happened, causing his goods, servants, and cattle to likewise increase. Therefore, they likely returned to Canaan with at least double, or perhaps more wealth than when they left Haran. The time of their return to Canaan was probably only about 6 months or so later, because it is unlikely Sarah was in Pharaoh's house more than a few months. And that means Canaan was still suffering from famine. It is therefore no wonder the land could not sustain the two families living together. The pasture land necessary in a famine-ravaged land would have been enormous. They had to go their separate ways, leaving Abraham and Sarah finally cut off from country, kin, and father, as God required they be when they were first told to go into Canaan. The promises required Abraham and Sarah to be alone in the land of Canaan, and God caused them to be alone through their own misadventuring into Egypt. Interestingly, famine was the reason they went down into Egypt. Yet God makes a specific point to emphasize that before and after their trek into Egypt, the Canaanite was in the land. The Canaanite and Perizzite dwelled in the land. The inference is the Canaanite and Perizzite didn't leave. They dwelled there throughout the famine. It was Abraham who didn't do what he was told to do. Go to a country, I will show you. There God would make Abraham into a great nation. In other words, go there, stay, dwell, don't leave. Abraham learned an awful lot from his dreadful decision to go down into Egypt. We are seeing Abraham and Sarah's faith being revealed as a growing faith, suffering ups and downs, just as James points out that faith and works of faith go hand in hand. Works of faith are how we deal with situations we face in life. James 2, verses 21 and 23 is the example of Abraham's faith being made perfect, quoted from Genesis 22, that Abraham was justified by works, the work being the offering of Isaac. But James says, this fulfilled scripture, quoting Genesis 15, that Abraham believed God, which was imputed unto Abraham for righteousness. The work of faith in offering Isaac was about 50 years after Abraham believed God. There are therefore two different events and time periods in his life. However, the point James makes is that works of faith over Abraham's lifetime made his faith perfect. Thus, perfect faith fulfilled what was said 50 years earlier. And with that, we close our thoughts this evening, having considered Abraham and Sarah, his wife, as they began walking the journey of faith together.